The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and to check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. For this week's episode, we're diving into the Sewers of Paris archives to revisit a chat with the wonderful Carlos Maza. You may know Carlos from the brilliant videos he's produced analyzing news and media, or you might know him from the big queer fuss that he caused last year when he shone a spotlight on the rampant harassment and discrimination problem faced by YouTube. Carlos and I spoke back in 2017 about his nerdiest interests, role-playing and video games, a medium in which he's given a lot of thought to whether he identifies as a fighter or a healer. In his videos, Carlos puts up a strong verbal fight, but off-screen, the role in which he's most at home is that of caretaker, looking after others and supporting the well-being of those around him. But as he's found, that doesn't always leave time for taking care of himself. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, I want to let you know about a whole bunch of live shows that I'm hosting in Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco. You've probably heard me mention my live comedy show and podcast, Queens of Adventure, which features drag queens playing Dungeons & Dragons. We'll be taking the stage at Rebar in Seattle on March 12th, and then at Emerald City Comic Con on March 13th. Then Queens of Adventure is doing two shows in Portland at the Siren Theater on March 18 and 19, and then even more at Oasis in San Francisco on March 25 and 29. Our Queens of Adventure live shows are a ton of fun. Basically, a big queer improvised comedy story powered by unpredictable dice rolls and a rowdy audience. Tickets are now on sale at queensofadventure.com. Hope to see you at those shows. Now, here's my 2017 interview with Carlos. Well, this week I'm speaking to Carlos Maza, a.k.a. Latin Thunder, video producer at Vox.com. Carlos, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
I was a massive, and still am to this day, a massive video game nerd. And when I was a kid, I got really into Japanese role-playing games on the PlayStation and the Super Nintendo, and those games have had like a tremendous impact on how I think about what it means to be a good person and what it means to be a man and what it means to have friendship and love in your life in ways that some are probably unhealthy and overly idealistic, but I think most people probably don't know about me that I have been like deeply shaped by the video games that I played when I was a fat loser nerd in high school and middle school and had no friends and had to turn to Final Fantasy to populate my social life.
So which, you said Final Fantasy, what other JRPGs are we talking about here?
So my favorite JRPG of all time and the one that inspired me to get my first tattoo was Suikoden 2 for the PlayStation. Suikoden 1 is also a really great game, but Suikoden 2 is the first time that I felt like I was playing a game and could see myself as a protagonist, and also became deeply invested in this idea that like the point of a human is to be guardian of others and to like help others and be a source of light for others. I think I had played already at that point like Final Fantasy VII, I had played Chrono Trigger, I played like a bunch of the basic, I had played FF Tactics, I had played like all of the basic PlayStation games, but or JRPGs, but in Suikoden 2, I don't know if you're familiar with the game, but the main character is defined by this like rune he finds on his right hand called the Bright Shield Rune that like basically guides him to be a source of like light and be a guardian for all these people that he leads. And I just became so enthralled with this idea that like the mark of a good person or the mark of a hero, and we all see ourselves as heroes in our own video games, is that you should be like this beacon of light for people around you, and that you should devote yourself to the defense and protection of those around you at all times. And that's like just like for someone who, I was an atheist from a very young age, so for someone who like didn't have some much bigger moral code that I was living by, to see that exemplified in a video game so well and to feel so connected to the main character was just very defining for me. So when I got my first tattoo, I got a shield on my right wrist to remember that, because it just seemed like it was just for a kid growing up who I'd been like bullied a bunch and felt really isolated and disconnected from like my actual peers, to have this like piece of art that just made a very compelling, moving case for being a source of light for those around you was really transformative. And aside from that, it's just like, I don't know if I can curse, but it's a fucking great game. Like, by far one of the best JRPGs ever to grace an American console. But just like really transformative. I've replayed it a bunch since then, and I still just am just as in love with it as ever. But I just remember the first game where I thought, where it really reminded me like, oh, this is a form of storytelling. Any video game is a form of storytelling. And this is a story that really deeply changes the way that I view what would make me a good or bad person in life.
So where were you growing up?
I was in Miami, Florida, which when people who are not from Miami hear that, they imagine Miami as being this like cosmopolitan, gay South Beach oasis that's like really party centric and really fun and open and progressive. That was not my experience in Miami, Florida. I grew up in like a really Catholic neighborhood. I went to an all-boy private Catholic school. I went to a private Hispanic middle school and elementary school. The neighborhood or the culture that I grew up in was like very machismo oriented, and it was just like not a great place for a super analytical queer kid growing up who had like stumbled into feminist anarchist literature at too early of an age. So I grew up feeling super marginalized, and I was just like very, very chubby. And so I spent a ton of my time playing JRPGs when I was growing up. I think the first one I ever played in a meaningful way was Chrono Trigger for the Super Nintendo. And the way that I got introduced to Chrono Trigger was my cousin would play Chrono Trigger as the main character Chrono, and I would just hold on. It was a one player game, and I would hold on to the second player controller and imagine myself controlling Luca, one of his sidekicks, who was this like nerdy, resourceful, inventive, romantically uninvolved, badass girl that just like hung out with him and had huge glasses. It was just really nerdy and was bound to her family and was just really inventive and was like the silent hero of the game. And I always imagined myself being Luca because I was like, oh, she's feminine, she's nerdy, she's low-key the hero of this game. And I just like imagined that I was controlling her. So that was like my first interaction with JRPGs. But to answer your question, I grew up in Miami. Sorry. I'm really long-winded.
It sounds like you really identified with the position she was taking. Like, did it feel like you were sort of, I don't know, like collaborating with the character on what she did?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure this is not like a unique experience for a queer kid growing up consuming any kind of media, like that you find a strong female lead who's an underdog and just like latch onto her because so much of that resonates with how you quietly feel about yourself. But yeah, it was A, my cousin was older, so he just like got to control the main character, and I was just relegated to the sidekick. But she has this really great scene at the beginning of the game where the main character is captured, this silent macho protagonist, and Luca, who has like been this weird oddball nerd, pulls off this like heroic, really valiant rescue. And her like fanfare music, her character music, is also like the victory music of the whole game. So there's just like this part of my brain that was like, she is the real main character. She is the hero of the game. And I don't technically have to control her, but you know, the main character needs me in this way. And so much of her just reminded me of myself. She was just like she did not look the part of the hero, but she was just like so badass that she just was. And she did it while being feminine and nerdy, which like is how I felt growing up. And so it was just very easy to become lost in that. And I've always made the joke that if I got to ever name a kid a daughter, I would name her Luca. And I will probably just end up naming a dog Luca at some point. But that character was just like such a defining. To see that in art, I feel like you didn't get to see a lot of that in media, especially as like a young kid in the environment that I was growing up in. There wasn't like a lot of depictions of heroic feminine nerdiness. It was just like so counter to the hero trope that we have in our heads. So to see that kind of like snuck into a JRPG very early on was super transformative for me, even though I don't think I had the language to describe it as such back then.
I had a really similar, I don't know if you want to call it relationship, but I had a similar feeling with Penny on Inspector Gadget.
Yeah.
There you have like that strong, nerdy, like she's so smart. She's got a computer book, for God's sake, which is the coolest thing ever. And now we just like walk around with them in our pockets. But yeah. At the time.
Or like Velma from Scooby-Doo. I feel like this is almost like a trope by accident. But the idea of like the strong, nerdy female sidekick. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, for me, I was like, that's all I want to be in my whole life. That's like the kind of hero that I would like to see myself as.
Can you describe to me your feelings towards Willow on Buffy?
I actually did not catch on to the Buffy phase, weirdly enough. It might have been because I was like a smidge too young for it. Like, it happened just before me. But I have a lot of friends who are really into Buffy, and she sounds basically like that same archetype. Like the hero who's not the hero, who's like unsure of herself, but secretly like really powerful. Because she's secretly really powerful in that show, right? Like, she ends up being really powerful.
I can give you no spoilers because you owe it to your soul to see Buffy.
I know. Once the world stops being on fire, I will like go into a cave with a laptop and just watch every Buffy episode and catch up on it. Gay men who I've talked to about it speak about it in the same way that I talk about some of my favorite video games, which is how I know it's real. It's not like the show's so good. It's like you can tell within 2 seconds of talking to somebody who loves Buffy that it means something very deep and powerful to them, which is how I know, like, I shouldn't mess with it. I should just, like, take it seriously and consume it when I have the time.
I will say, the first season is a little hit or miss, so don't be turned off by the first season.
Fair. But,
you know, finds its footing. I have so many questions for you. Tell me how you mentioned that you discovered, first of all, that you were an atheist, but you were in this very religious environment. Mm-hmm. So did you make a break with religion, or was that something that was sort of a decision that was made for you?
It's so weird. I think I made it, but I don't ever remember it being even really controversial within my family. I like had a religion class constantly in middle school and elementary school, because it was like a private Catholic Cuban school. And then I went to a high school that was run by brothers. It was a Marist high school, private Catholic in Miami. So it was like always a thing. But I remember the time that I got to high school, I was already an atheist. I think I have like a joke, though this might be more me embellishing than reality, that when my dad told me Santa wasn't real, I was like, yeah, and neither is God. Like, it's just like that quickly of a progression. But I also went to a school that I wasn't like religious in an aggressively anti-gay way, but it was just like Catholicism in Miami, Florida at that time was just anti-gay. Like, I remember reading Leviticus at a very, very young age and something in my brain just being like, I don't like it. This doesn't seem right. I don't like it. Not really having the language to say, oh, I'm queer and this is offensive, but something about it just became very disconnected from my sense of self. And also, like, my dad was kind of like an anti-capitalist agnostic, like pretty radical for a Catholic neighborhood in Miami. And my mom was like religious only in the sense that like she would light a candle when she went to a church in Europe, like very specific kind of religious that wasn't super devout. And then when I actually did get exposed to like regular organized religion, it was when my mom got remarried to this shitty dude who would like make us say grace at the table and make us excuse ourselves before we got up. It was just like, my negative feelings about my mom's new husband were wrapped up in my negative feelings about his faith, too. So it was just like a very natural thing for me to pull away from God early on in life. And then it helped that I like joined the debate team really early in high school, which, unless you have like a really, really, really religious background, being exposed to debate and other kids from across the country will just like make you naturally more skeptical and suspicious of organized belief. And so that helped me too. But I think everything was like, all the odds for me staying in religion were not good. Like everything I was exposed to was, he's gonna have a negative reaction and then never come back to the church. And sure enough, that's what happened.
Did you literally say to your dad, like when he was like, Santa isn't real, did you actually say, yeah, neither is God?
No, I don't remember if that's like a fancy story I tell myself about what I thought, but I remember hearing Santa wasn't real and thinking, that seems so obvious that it feels silly that we're talking about this. And at that point, it was like I think it was just like I was already suspicious of God and religion as being something meaningful, that I was very skeptical about it. And so something about having the one big dogma knockdown for me was just like an affirmation that all big dogmas are probably going to be bullshit at some point, and I'm just like waiting it out until my dad sits me down and says God isn't real. So it was just like a kind
sorry,
of a
did chance. You did you just refer to Santa as the one big dogma?
Yeah, it's like the first big God figure you have in your life, right? Okay. Is Santa. And once that gets knocked down, you're like, oh, I don't even get gifts. All right, none of this stuff. All this stuff is suspect now. I don't trust any of this anymore.
Did that give you any anxiety? Like, there's a lot of comfort in knowing that there's someone taking care of everything.
I don't know. I never really felt anxious about it because God wasn't a figure for me that offered much comfort to begin with. Like, my parents never talked to me about God or heaven in like a super consistent way. And so I didn't grow, it wasn't like I felt like I had lost a security blanket. It was like the security blanket was never there. And I imagine it probably felt a lot like kids who just grow up in atheistic households where it's just like it doesn't become part of your worldview and so there's nothing to lose. It was like really only a thing that I ever heard about in school in the context of religion classes. So it's like, I was as enamored with the idea of God as I was with the idea of algebra or like any other school concept. And so it was like pretty easy for me to discard it once I realized that that like my dad wasn't particularly wedded to it either, and the people who seemed to be really wedded to it were kind of shitty in a lot of contexts to me. It was like this. It was like the mean religion teacher at school. Like, I didn't have like many role models who were showing me a super compelling, attractive side of what devout faith would look like. And so it was pretty easy for me to shake off. I don't think I felt anxious about it.
I love the comparison of God to algebra, as they're both systems of making sense of things that are a little outside of what we have the resources to understand ourselves.
And a thing that I'm bad at, like naturally, that I'm naturally not going to perform well in, which makes me even more reluctant to take them that seriously. If I'm not good at it, it must be fake.
Sure. Great. Did you ever have conflicts with that machismo culture around you?
Yes. It's so weird because like when you're experiencing it at that age, you like don't think of it as, you don't have the language to describe it as I'm having a conflict with machismo culture. It's like it looks like so many other things before you see it for what it is. But I just like a lot of the bullshit about masculinity that I'm sure most American men internalize just takes on a very specific and hypercharged context, or at least it did for me. And so I have like some unpleasant memories growing up about being feminine or overly emotional or even just like campy in my behavior, and being punished very strongly for them, either by a parent figure or by just like my peers in class. And you don't, if you grew up in Miami, you don't think of it as like machismo culture, you just think of it as culture, because you don't really have like a white norm that you're comparing what you're experiencing to. It's just like you grow up in a bubble. And so you don't have the language of machismo when you're just experiencing it as like the language of how I navigate every day. But I had some super negative experiences of that being policed in surprising ways. I have somewhat of the luxury, or maybe like the scar of never having performed femininity that aggressively, but still aggressively enough that I have like these experiences of just like stern retribution for it. And it's a thing that I like still have to grapple with in therapy even today. It's like not a thing that you walk off that easily, because like I said, you like don't notice it happening. Like I feel like it's so much easier to grapple with this stuff when it's an event as opposed to the background noise of your life. And so yeah, I experienced that a lot. I like did, I was like into drama and stuff like that when I was in middle school. Which gave me some outlet. I was like really into art, and like I was like a yearbook editor, and so I had like a lot of artistic outlets. But when I got to high school, it became competitive debate, which is like very easy to pass off to like not experience campiness or femininity in a debate setting. And so I got to like avoid a lot of it. But yeah, I definitely had, that's a really vague way of saying, yes, I had really unpleasant experiences of failing to meet a certain cultural standard. I also went to a high school that was like aggressively sports dominated, where the jocks were just idealized to really an extreme extent, and to where I had teachers participating in like really open displays of homophobia really regularly. And for someone who was out really young and was the captain of the debate team, it was just like a constant, really aggressive feeling of I don't fit in and this sucks, which I think is part of why I became so easily lost in video games, is that they give you a space where you're like, you have the freedom to even in your own head imagine the hero being much more feminine than maybe he's being displayed on TV without any kind of punishment for it. But yeah, I had a lot of experiences of feeling like an outsider that I think shaped me in super fundamental ways that I don't think I realized until really recently how much they affected both the type of media I consumed and what that media meant to me.
Are there specific events that stick with you as sort of exemplifying that sort of culture that you're trying to navigate?
Yeah, there's like this one really unpleasant one that I like didn't recognize for what it was until a couple of years after it happened. But I was like over at a cousin's house with my dad, and I grew up in like a really big Cuban family, so like we had like 20 cousins who were all within the same generation who would hang out with each other a lot. And we were playing, it was like the cousins and I were playing some board game or something, and a big part of my identity growing up was like being the joker, or like the funny one or the clown. And I think a lot of like queer kids adopt that as a self-defense mechanism to avoid being targeted. It's like you just become funny and silly. For some reason, I was like on this kick that day of playing a really feminine character, like an over-the-top fae, like just silly. I was just doing a silly voice during the video game, during the board game that we were playing. And one of my cousins got annoyed with it and told my dad. And there was just like this really super unpleasant public shaming that also resulted in some like physical contact that was like super inappropriate, like just like physical punishment that was really surprising. Surprising not because it was physical, but because at that point, like, I was like a really good kid and had like not gotten in trouble a lot. And so I had this moment of not expecting that at all, and then suddenly being really aggressively punished in front of my peers for a display of femininity that, to me, like, I did not understand why that was bad or why it was wrong. And that was like at a pretty young age that I think just I felt when I was being funny and silly and doing the character that I was like showing the best side of me, that I was like creative and could embody another character and I was making people laugh and was just, I was being interesting. And so to have that so aggressively policed by a trusted parental figure in front of trusted family members was super, super jarring. And like, I think you learn that lesson once and then you don't need to learn it again. It's like something that fucks with like your basic, the basic calculations you make before you do engage in any kind of behavior. And then there are other ones, like I had to sit through my family debating whether gay people should be allowed to raise kids, like stuff like that, which isn't really a policing of masculinity, but is a just like a policing of possibility that shapes the way that you think about yourself. I think in a weird way, it like made me a much better debater when I joined debate, that I could like tolerate really extreme upsetting arguments and keep my cool about them. But yeah, that stuff was like really definitive. And then I went to a high school where it was like very common to get like the back of your belt zip tied to your chair so you couldn't get up. People would like steal your backpack and like write really disgusting things on it in chalk. I had people like write things on the back of my shirt when I was like trying to focus in class. I'd get called a faggot a lot. I had like a teacher that I loved who would just like call kids faggots in class really frequently. I had like teachers who were progressive who would call kids faggots in class, like stuff like that. And I was already out at that point in high school.
Oh, geez.
So it's like there's a weird like leaving your body that you have to do to survive that kind of environment where you're just like totally, you can't let yourself be affected by any of it because you would just like freak out. And I think a lot of that stuff trains you, even though no one ever says we're policing your femininity, to like just become very aware of how you're appearing, what you react to. You become suspicious of stuff that you don't think would put you in danger. Like, I think we all have pretty good judgment about like what kind of behavior is inappropriate, what kind of behavior is destructive. And I think being policed for femininity as a queer kid makes you aware that your internal gauge for that is off and that you're actually more prone to danger than you thought you were. And that makes you naturally more defensive and cautious in those scenarios. Like, you never know when your parent is going to get mad at you for being too feminine when you didn't think you were doing something wrong and really embarrass you. And so all of your behavior after that becomes naturally more cautious, even if you're not getting overt signals that you're running the risk of doing something inappropriate.
When you had to do that sort of dissociation and kind of leaving yourself so that you could just withstand all the terrible stuff that you were hearing, like, was that followed like in private by you kind of like sort of crashing violently back into yourself?
I don't know. I think I've spent a tremendous amount of time losing myself into fantasy type media because the reality was intolerable in a lot of ways. I think I hyper-developed parts of my personality that gave me the freedom to be a little bit more flexible in how I like presented gender, presented myself.
Which parts of your personality?
I think like being silly or being comedic became a huge part of my identity. And I can look back at it now and be like, yeah, I'm a funny person. So I'm a funny kid and I use humor because I'm good at it. But looking back realistically, it was just a super important defense mechanism that if I could make my femininity or my weirdness into a joke, you disarm some of your potential antagonizers or some of the police. That if you like live in the world of characters or parody or silliness, that it means that you're less culpable for like actual punishment than if someone were to see you as genuinely being more loose with how you presented yourself. And then I spent a tremendous amount of time by myself and playing video games and playing with like fantasy figurines and getting lost in these like other worlds because there's just like a degree of freedom there that doesn't exist. Or I should say, it's not even that there's freedom, because like I think a lot of, you can make a really good critique of a lot of modern even role-playing games that they also subscribe to like masculine bullshit ideas about what a man or what a hero looks like. I think it's just like you don't run the risk of terror from people that you trust in a video game. Like if someone, I've always been drawn to video games that let you develop big parties of people, like big groups of players that you control and who all work together and who are led by one person. Because then built into the game's mechanics is an assumption that they will always stick with you and they won't betray you and that you can rely on these people and that they like you for you. And there's not the like natural fear that I think a queer kid brings into every social interaction of like, I could do something that causes all this to turn super quickly and then that would make me really vulnerable. And so I've never been a big fan of like video games where it's just like Skyrim type games where it's just one hero alone in the world. I've always liked games that like Baldur's Gate, where you get to develop a friendship with peers over time with the knowledge that basically no matter who you are as a person, those people aren't going to turn on you and aren't going to betray you. And the game is set up so that you will be liked and that you will become a leader and a hero, which is just, I think, a very different parameter to operate in than if you're a queer kid and you're like, literally a parent could turn on me. Like, there is no ally who is a true ally if I misstep in some way. And so I think I just really relied on those spaces. And it's why, like, so much of my idea about what friendship should look like and what romance should look like were influenced by these games where you had the ability to be emotional and vulnerable and long for people and not run the risk of it blowing up in your face. Sorry that's really long-winded. I haven't thought about it this way in a while, but it's like there's something about a video game that treats you like a hero and that treats you as someone who is liked by a wide cast of characters that I think meets a need that a lot of queer kids don't get met, which is the world wants you here. And reinforcing that the world wants you here, even if it's a very limited digital world. And I think that's kind of where I hid for a long time and still find myself hiding on bad days.
At what point did you start finding other people who liked the same thing?
It came in waves. So I think joining debate is maybe what saved my life in high school. Not because it gave me a bunch of space to be queer or feminine, because it didn't, but because it gave me space to flex a part of my identity that wasn't getting a lot of validation, which is like being cerebral or thoughtful or self-reflective. Debate really rewards nerds who do a lot of research and spend a lot of time thinking about their arguments and being tough on themselves and pushing themselves to be compelling and to think of like the worst possible case scenario and then prepare for it. And so I did really well in debate and got to spend a lot of time around other kids who I think also loved debate because they weren't fitting into their own social networks. And so I got to meet other freaks and other nerds. They wanted to be good at something and were good at this one thing and had, in my experience, had usually experienced social trauma in ways that made them very self-aware and very self-reflective at a young age, because I think like the natural reaction to being traumatized by another person is to suddenly become very thoughtful about what caused you to get there. And so in my experience, like queer people or people who are bullied have like an incredible ability to talk about themselves and like how they behave certain ways and why they behave certain ways. And that was just very helpful to be around those types of people growing up. There were like gay debaters who were heroes who were like badasses in the community when I was in debate, who I could look up to, even though that like brought on its own new generation of trauma in its own ways.
What do you mean?
Even the really talented high school gay debater is a severely wounded person who has been through a bunch of bullshit in their lives and like doesn't have the language or experience to deal with their own wounds. And so if you idolize that person and try to get really close to that person, those wounds will blow up in your face too, which is a really fancy way of saying I like fell in love with the few representations I had of gay men, and they were like in no place to love back a young, nerdy, really insecure gay kid. And so it was like you had this relief of meeting other gay people and feeling like, oh, I'm like you, we're similar, this is a solution. And then suddenly having this new traumatic experience of like, none of these gay guys want anything to do with me, I'm inadequate. The trauma that I experience in straight spaces is also going to follow me into gay spaces. There's no escape. Like, and I'm sure that's true for a lot of queer people, like who go from having nothing to entering very queer spaces. Is like, you expect it to be a total, like an oasis. And when it isn't like that, you can like start to believe that everything is fucked and that there really is no escape. I know I had that experience, like when I moved to DC and suddenly was around a lot of gay people, of still feeling in new ways like, I don't fit in, I don't belong here, the problem is me, it's not who I'm around. Like, that kind of stuff can be really traumatic on its own. So the first time I really experienced that was being gay in debate and being like, oh, these badasses who are really smart and really talented and really successful still don't like me. The problem is not that I've been marginalized, the problem is that there's something like fundamentally broken in me that can't be fixed and that everyone can detect, gay or straight. So that was like its own set of like psychological issues to deal with. But just being around nerds was very, very helpful. Being around people who liked that I could talk pretty and that I was self-reflective and would reward me for it with trophies was like a very empowering experience, and reminded me that as awful as high school was, there is like possibility for other stuff. And then when I got to college, it was like the beginning of real meaningful friendships with straight men. That weren't destructive but weren't dangerous, which is like an important part of my healing process. Still not a lot of gay people. And then when I got to DC, again, like the beauty of being able to go to a gay bar and it not be unusual, but you know, still the drawback of, I don't feel like I belong in here. I feel like I just got dropped into a community that still doesn't know what to do with me or want me, or that I'm not performing well enough for. So it just comes in waves. It still comes in waves. Sorry, that's really long-winded too.
Did you have a sense that like, okay, well, I've got this like nerd side of myself that's super into these JRPGs, and then I've got this like gay side of myself that just wants to hang out with these gay men who seem to like something else? And did you feel like you were just caught between a bunch of worlds and there was nobody in the same sort of overlap of Venn diagrams as you?
Yes, absolutely. Before I answer, I should just say, and you probably get this a lot, but like, you are a great listener and question asker, so thank you for indulging me and like letting me wax poetic about this stuff. It feels very nice to be able to talk about this stuff in like a non-judgmental space. Yeah, the answer to your question is yes. It still feels like the part of me that I hung out with the most when I was growing up, which was like the nerdy JRPG video game part, is divorced from the queer part of me. And those parts like kind of have to live separately. I like have never really had the privilege of being exposed to like a queer gamer space. And so my first understandings of what queer spaces look like came from pop culture in ways that like weren't particularly attractive. Like whether it was like watching Queer as Folk when I would get a chance to, or like watching gay characters on The Real World, or just like,
well, Queer as Folk. Didn't Queer as Folk like literally have a character who was like his deal was that he was a gay nerd and he had a comic book shop, I think?
That might have been true. The only times I ever saw Queer as Folk were when my dad would watch it with my stepmom. Oh. And I would like walk by, obviously not linger for very long. And I remember seeing like these club and like sex scenes that like were not put in any context for me and thinking, oh, that's not, like, I can't do that at all. Like, that feels so far away from who I am as a person. So there actually might have been a gay nerd Queer as Folk character. The way that I was exposed to it was, like, walking in the background of the living room and seeing, like, hearing house music and watching a techno, like, a hookup scene and thinking, ah, fuck, like, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to do that. And I think that's probably, like, I've texted friends about this before. Like, a lot of gay cultures also, the way you're socialized into it is through pornography, which offers a very limited and just unrealistic depiction of what queerness looks like, and just a very unhealthy depiction of what queerness as an identity looks like. And so for me, even like aside from watching Queer as Folk in passing, a lot of it was just like watching pornography, and that is like just so divorced. This is a very different kind of storytelling, to put it super, super narrowly. And so when I first like got to, and then like I went to college where every queer person I met was like terrified of coming out, was going out to gay bars, but said they were going to still marry a woman and like have kids. It was like
What kind of college were you going to?
I went to Wake Forest, which is like it's a conservative like school in North Carolina, in Winston-Salem, which is like not a big city at all. And so
what made you go there instead of like, you said that you'd gotten into like anarchist feminist literature.
Yeah.
Like, the reason why didn't you go someplace more adventurous?
Because Wake had a great debate program and I really wanted to debate. Okay. And they, offered me money to debate for them. And I loved their style of debate. And I knew that's what I wanted to do in college because it's like what got me through high school. So it's the only school I applied to. I just like only applied to Wake and got in. Obviously not thinking at that point that I would like need, you know, my consideration was not like I need to be around queer spaces. It was I need to be around debate spaces because that's what makes me feel good. And so, yeah, I got there and it was just like just a very unhealthy depiction of what queerness can look like. And then when I got to D.C., your first impulse is like to go out to bars or go out to clubs, which, again, is just like a very narrow sliver of what queerness as an experience is like. And so my first reaction was or my general feeling almost always was, I just can't do this. Just isn't me. Like I could perform to exist in this space, but like there's an authentic Carlos who's sitting on the inside of my body, who wants to go home and play video games and feel liked and be a hero. And then there's queer Carlos on the outside who's like going to bars and feeling like I can't do this and I'm not attractive enough and I'm not hip enough. And that if they ever found out that I was like a huge World of Warcraft nerd, that they're never going to want to go home with me. And there's just like something fundamentally that I have to hide. And I don't think even as an adult that I have truly reconciled those two bubbles in a really healthy way. I recognize that there are those spaces and that exists. But it feels like, I think in my head, there's just like a script that to engage in one means putting the other on hold. And that's like a kind of difficult script to untangle. So much of imagining the queer experience of growing up is like compartmentalizing different parts of your identity so you can hang out in some of them safely without having to unleash all the others. And I think it's difficult to unlearn that behavior. Like a thing that I deal with in therapy a lot still is like, how do you let all parts of you show up or give the freedom of all parts of you to show up in social interactions without fearing that opening one door will cause people around you to freak out and suddenly not want to spend time with you anymore. And it's like that's like a very difficult process to learn if you grew up thinking that compartmentalizing like that was like a very successful survival mechanism, which it was for me growing up.
Regarding gay bars, you do realize that everyone at the gay bar, including the go-go dancers, is thinking to themselves, what if I'm not pretty enough? What if I'm not good enough?
Yes.
Like, that is just what humans do.
For sure. Yes. I intellectually recognize that. And in terms of like feeling it, I'm in a much different place now than I was growing up and first experiencing that for the first time. But I just don't think, at least for me, I like didn't have a mentor who was like saying stuff like that to me. And so I was experiencing it in a very lonely way. And it's very easy when you experience it in a lonely way, if you already have this suspicion that there's something fundamentally wrong with you, to feel negative things and to just have them filter through the lens of, it's because something is wrong with just me. And like it's almost like the trauma you experienced growing up, which is very lonely, makes it so that all trauma feels like it's unique and special to you. And it's like very difficult as like a young growing up gay kid, I say young in terms of like early 20s, to have the distance or the external voice that pulls you out of that and says, it's just a human thing. Like what you're going through is normal. You can't take it that way or like be sweet with yourself. If you don't have a mentor, which I didn't, who is like putting you on pause to say that stuff, it just becomes super calcified. It's like, it's tough to unlock that stuff. If you're going into that situation with a bunch of presuppositions that are like, something is wrong with me, it's uniquely me, and it's my job to try to hide that for as long as I can because danger lurks around every corner. Like, that's just it's fucking tough to be reasonable and distant from your ego when those are your internal scripts that are already running on the inside and you enter into a gay bar for the first time.
You structured your entire college career around being reasonable.
Yeah. I have, there's a big disconnect between my ability to hyper-rationalize and be analytical about everything, and to have language to talk about everything, and an intense inability to pull myself out of that with reason when you're feeling it. And it's like, it's almost like both to my advantage and disadvantage that I can distance feeling from thinking so aggressively. It's an advantage because it's how I survived high school, is like, just be rational and don't be distraught by what's happening around you. But it means that when I do feel like particularly vulnerable or wounded by something, that I often need to just like walk away, because I have an inability to catch myself in those moments. I'm getting better, I think. But yeah, the irony is not lost on me that I can talk pretty about everything except when it comes to personal pain, and then I have like no smart thoughts at all about why I'm freaking out and how to stop myself from doing it.
When did you get your tattoo?
I got my first ones on January 1st of this year. So the two on my wrists are, on my right is the shield rune, which is from that video game. On my left is a pause button, which in retrospect to the side looks like an HRC symbol, which is, I recognize, is very cliche for a gay person. But it's inspired by this concept of the sacred pause, which is like, stop yourself when you're freaking out or lashing out at people, and ask yourself, what do I need right now? What's not getting met? And then I have some other tattoos on my left arm that are like homages to loneliness, or like the idea that it is okay to be lonely and to hang out with the self, and that the feeling of isolation, or that there's some experiences that are just yours that you won't be able to communicate to others ever, is okay and is a part of life that you should feel romantic about rather than frustrated or angry about.
Well, being isolated and having solitude isn't the same as being lonely.
Yeah, I think what I've been thinking about a bunch is that there is an element of the human experience that is going to be naturally lonely. That there is, because language cannot effectively communicate how we feel in its entirety, it can like get pretty close, but not entirely. And because everyone else is the main character of their own stories, there's going to be some stuff that is like, is just for you. And I think I've thought about that previously as a burden or a curse, or like some sign that there's something like deeply wrong with me, that I don't feel constantly understood. I feel like I can't communicate how I'm feeling a lot. And I think some of the work that I've been doing in therapy is like, maybe just becoming a little bit more enamored with the idea that it's kind of cool that as humans, we all carry around parts of our stories that like we just cannot express to others. And that there's some experiences about being ourselves that only we will ever know, and that that's okay and not a sign of failure, as opposed to the temptation to like be super open about everything and try to make people understand, and then getting frustrated when people don't understand. I think I'm like working on treating the parts of me that can't be communicated to others and the parts of me that are just for me with respect, as opposed to as some flaw and or some bug in the machine that I can't get out.
What made you decide at the beginning of this year to get those tattoos?
I had been doing video work at my old job for Media Matters, and I knew that I was starting this job at Vox. And one of the temptation, or one of the dangers of this job, is that you're getting a bunch of validation from strangers on the internet that you don't know and who don't actually care about you. And it can
Well, describe the work that you're doing.
So I make videos focused on like media criticism, or like critical analysis of news media. So I do videos about like how we cover Trump, how journalism's norms like don't work under Trump anymore. And then before I did video before Trump, BT, I like did videos about like how we talk about Black Lives Matter protests, how we talk in media, and how that like reinforces racist tropes, or about how myths about voter fraud get popularized. So I just like do a video series that's like me on camera talking about different things that happen in media, and I try to use like comedy and a bunch of evidence and like some like personality stuff to make it digestible and make it not seem so academic. It's a really cool job. I love it. But one of the drawbacks is that people are judging, when people judge your work, they're also judging you to some extent. Like they're looking at your face and talking about your personality. And it's negative feedback sucks, yada, yada. We don't talk about it. What's challenged me and what's been difficult is positive feedback, because as like a person who grew up feeling like nobody liked them, it's very seductive when strangers on the internet are saying nice things about you to like get wrapped up in that, and to like try to use that as a drug or as a crutch to deal with your own feelings of like, I feel lonely, I feel unseen, I feel insecure about myself. And so the tattoos were like realizing that I was going to start a part of my career that involved a lot more of that. And it was like a way of showing myself, reminding myself that my body is not, does not belong to anyone else, that I get to define what I look like and what is meaningful to me, and that I, basically that I, my body's going to die at some point and go away. And so while it's here, I should feel like I have full ownership of it. And doing public-facing video work can challenge that and make you feel like the public owns your body and the public owns your face and your personality. So it's, it was almost like my little act of resistance. I also got my ears pierced. Like, I did a bunch of little things to just remind myself that, like, my body is not art for consumption. It's a thing that belongs to me, and it's it, I can make it look how I choose to make me feel like it belongs to me more.
You described people approving of you and giving you compliments as something that could be a drug or a crutch. And it sounds like you make it sound like compliments are, or approval are necessarily a bad thing, but compliments can be really healthy too.
Yeah, they can. I think they become dangerous for me because I can use them, I can use them the wrong way. So if you, they can become a substitute for the love that you should be giving to yourself, if that makes sense. That I think that a big challenge for me is working on falling in love with myself and liking parts of myself that I was taught to not like. And if you're getting a bunch of validation from strangers on the internet, it's tempting to say, oh, I'm good so long as strangers on the internet like me. The thing is, that will go away at some point, and strangers on the internet don't actually love you. They just like a thing that you did on the internet for right now, and they're gonna forget about you at some point. And at some point, I'll make a shitty video that people don't like, or at some point Vox will want me to stop making videos because they don't like me anymore. And so if I build my self-worth or self-esteem around something that fleeting, I'm in a really dangerous spot. And it's not just like preparing for something catastrophic. Like, what if I don't make a video for 3 weeks? That means for 3 weeks I'm not getting validation from the public. Am I a mess at that point? And so I just don't want it to become a crutch or a substitute for the more meaningful love that I should be giving to myself in my life, if that makes sense.
What's the last compliment you gave yourself?
God. I don't know. I don't know.
Would you like to give yourself one right now?
Sure. I'll say, Carlos, it is good that you can be honest about stuff that makes you uncomfortable, because it's probably helpful to other Carloses out there.
I'm glad that that's the one that you went with, because that was the one that I wanted to give you.
So I saved you time.
I want to ask you a little more about why those specific tattoos that you got. You got the pause button that you said that you needed to step back and see, why am I lashing out? And then you got the shield on your other wrist. What are those two things attached to?
So the pause button is, the shield, I had this idea that all of my tattoos on my right arm would be about how I treat other people, and all the tattoos on my left arm would be about how I treat myself. So the shield is on my right, and it's just a reminder to be that hero whose life work is dedicated to helping others. I think I got it because I knew that this job would be really tempting to make me a narcissist, and to make my MO about doing stuff that made me feel like I was being cute and the people on the internet liked me and that I was like being really charming. That's a very addictive drug. And so the tattoo is a reminder that none of that stuff is meaningful if it doesn't make the world tangibly better, and that my purpose is to help, just fucking help in some way. And that, don't worry less about being cute. You're going to stop being cute at some point. Worry less about being likable. You're going to stop being likable at some point. That's like a reminder to bring me back down to earth, that like there's still that person inside of me who knows that if when I die, there's a divine that puts on a scale all the things I took from the world, all the things I gave back, that if the stuff I gave back doesn't outweigh the stuff I took, that that's going to really fucking suck. And I should make sure that the side of the stuff I gave back is really heavy. The pause button is just because I've had a lot of experiences in life causing harm to people that I love because I was feeling threatened or wounded or scared. And instead of stopping and considering why I was feeling that way and being honest about how I was feeling, I just externalized violence and brutality on others. Not physical violence, but like emotional violence or thoughtlessness. I have this skill from debate of being really good at like verbally brutalizing people and just like destroying them and knowing what will cause the most damage. And I've done that in really destructive and ways that I'm not proud of. And the pause button is a reminder that when I find myself doing that, it probably means that I have not stopped and asked myself, like, Carlos, are you okay? Carlos, what do you need? What are you actually worried about right now? Instead of being a dick to other people. And so it's just like it's an attempt to have a physical stopgap that when I'm being destructive, to remind myself, like, you got this tattoo because you know that you do this when you need something and when you're scared. So what is it that's causing it? And deal with that first, as opposed to harming people you love just because you like haven't had practice stopping yourself in those moments of panic.
These remind me a bit of those, plus the other tattoos that you mentioned on your arm. It's a bit like the armor and equipment that you put on a character in a game to develop their story and also to establish their alignment.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, anytime I play a video game where I can create like a character class, I always go for the healer type, defensive guardians, the paladins, the clerics. That's like my MO, is I always do that. And it's because I want myself to be that way. And so, yeah, both of those things, I thought about getting some kind of weapon tattoo or like something that was more in the style of like an actual main character in an RPG, but I've always just been drawn more to the protective one. I think part of it might be being queer too, because like in video games, the trope is always that like the female is the healer, the female has curative magic, like the feminine one is the support character. And I've just always been really enamored with the idea of the support character, someone whose main job is to help and heal. And I think it's why I love Suikoden 2 so much, is that that main character was a support character. Like, he has this incredible power to heal, and that's like what his shtick is. But yeah, it's that way of operating has always appealed to me, and I'm not really sure why, but I got a PlayStation VR headset the other day, and I thought about what would happen if like they ever made a really good RPG that you could actually be in, and like what I would do in it. And I do think I would just be like the healer guardian class. When I played Guild Wars, I was the guardian. Like, it's always been a thing for me. And I don't know why. I think it's a healthy alternative to the idea of masculinity and manhood that I got growing up, which like defines masculinity or manhood through brutality and violence and physical strength. And it's this like counter narrative that, you know, being a man or being an adult means helping and shielding others when you can. That's always just really appealed to me. Like, I like that I have a shield in my hand because it A, shows that I'm a nerd that I can't really deny, and B, shows what kind of nerd and like why I'm drawn to it. Not because I have delusions of violent grandeur, but because I would really like that when I died and people were at my funeral, that the only real thought they had about me was he like tried his best to help, and that's what he was aimed around, and the shield to me represents that.
When you were young and you were playing these games like Suikoden, it sounds like these games helped you figure out, you know, through the lens of the game, right and wrong and your own moral code, at a time when the moral code of the people around you, the religion, clearly was insufficient for you. And now it sounds like you're in a place where you don't need a game to tell you what your moral code is. You've developed a moral code for yourself that now you're expressing literally, physically through your body, but also through your words and your deeds and your actions.
Yeah, it's weird that I like never even really thought of religion as like a moral code when I was growing up, because it just felt like a series of really weird rules. And I think that if religion had been presented to me as like the more Christ-like moral code, that young Carlos probably would have been very enamored and seduced by it. Because even now as an adult, I can look back at like the truly Christian, like so much of of Christian teaching about morality is actually very attractive and appeals to my sense of like sacrifice and guardianship of others. The thing that drew me to JRPGs, the reason I never got into like normal fighting games or games like really like Skyrim or like any of the other like Call of Duty type games is I think because they lacked that idea of exploring how you relate to the world and to others and what your role is in terms of like morality. That JRPGs always, those stories always did a really good job of exploring like what does it mean to be a hero? What does a hero look like? What are some of the challenges and what makes this character likable? And so, yeah, I do think it did influence the way I thought about, I say adulthood interchangeably with manhood because I think those things are similar, but they like explored what it means to be good in a way that was very easy for me to access and was very simple and that cared nothing about the things that I was most insecure about. Like, to be good in that case did not mean being really serious. It meant like just doing, being helpful, doing what was good. Or being good didn't really mean being really violent. It was like putting yourself in harm's way, taking care of others, and being sweet and affectionate. And my moral code has evolved a lot since then. Like, video games are limiting in their own sense, in that like you are obviously never going to be an actual silent protagonist. You're obviously not the hero of a story where everyone else is a side character. Like, there's a degree of humility that you have to learn as an adult too. But this idea that when you're doing your work day to day, that you should be trying to do it in service of others has shaped me a lot. I think it's the reason I didn't go to law school, is I thought that it to me felt like becoming a drone for a firm, and I wanted to do nonprofit work instead. It gave me the confidence that like you should be able to use your voice in a proactive way and should act sometimes like the hero, even if you know that you are not the hero of the story. Like, put yourself out there, take risks. But yeah, it's weird to get a moral code that way, because I don't think the game designers think of themselves as doing that. And also, you're dealing with like many game designers across many games who all have, I'm sure, different ideas of what a moral code looks like. But the one thing that was in common was serve others, be stubborn and brave in the face of adversity, trust that you can do this. That kind of stuff, I don't even know if I think of it as a moral code, but it's the stuff that I say to myself in moments of panic or anxiety. Like, even when I was applying for this job, the only reason I had, I think, the guts to ask for it and to pitch it was because there's a part of me that still thinks of myself as like the main character of Suikoden 2, and that if that guy could build an army and fight the Empire, I could convince Vox to hire me for a video series.
Well, Carlos, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for being such a good listener.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Carlos for joining me. A quick reminder that my live drag comedy show, Queens of Adventure, is doing a ton of shows in March, featuring drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. We're coming to Rebar and Emerald City Comic Con in Seattle, to the Siren Theater in Portland, and to Oasis in San Francisco. Tickets are now on sale at queensofadventure.com. Hope to see you there. Thanks to everyone who's reviewed The Sewers of Paris on your podcast platform of choice. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Check us out there, or reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin McLeod of Incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.